Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is November 15th, 2015, and this is episode 97, episode 97, Leave Luck to Heaven, a brief history of Nintendo. Welcome once again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week, we're continuing our Ninty 90s and taking a look at the not-so-secret history of Nintendo, and their rise from a little toy maker focused on playing cards to one of the preeminent creators of electronic entertainment in the modern age. So buckle in and get ready for that. But first, we have our usual slate of follow-ups and news bits for your perusal. Slaggy, do you want to get us started?
Yeah, so this is almost kind of some doom and gloom, because Final Fantasy XI is finally going to be coming to a close.
Womp, womp.
Yeah, so, you know, it's been around for 14 years almost at this point, and if you were an old subscriber and you'd like to be part of the finale, then you can take advantage of a free offer. So
yeah, I actually think it's really cool that Square Enix is doing this for lapsed Final Fantasy XI subs, that you get to come back and play for free to sort of take part in the end of the game stuff. I just think it's super classy. I think it's really cool. And I absolutely think that, you know, I hope that more companies, as we start to see some MMOs wrap up, because, you know, Final Fantasy XI is not the only one looking a little old in the tooth. I hope we see more MMOs do like an end-of-life event, welcome people back for free. I just think it's such a cool idea. Some of us, you know, we put a lot of our lives into this game, Final Fantasy XI in particular. So to at least get to come back and see it off is, I think, something really special and cool.
Yeah, so that campaign is happening from actually started on Friday, and we'll be going until Tuesday, November 24th. So,
excellent.
Godspeed, Final Fantasy 14, Final Fantasy 11, and, you know, thankfully we still have 14, you know, to kind of carry forward.
Carry on, my wayward son. We also have word here that due to fan demand, Sony in North America, so that is to say Sony Computer Entertainment America, has confirmed that they will be releasing Gravity Rush Remastered for PS4 in retail form. Physical copies will be shipping in North America on February 9th for $30, and the game is available for pre-order at most of your favorite retailers.
I just want to know if we're going to get that amazing Figma of Cat.
Oh my gosh, right? As far as I know, the only region that's getting the Figma bundle is Japan, but it might be worth importing over. That Figma looks so good.
Right.
So, in addition to these follow-ups, we also have some release dates. We have word here that Life is Strange will be getting a full 5-part retail release. Or that is to say, a single retail release, including all 5 parts of the game. This will be releasing in North America on January 19th for PS4 and Xbox One. We also have word that the much-acclaimed visual novel Clannad will be releasing on Steam in English on November 23rd.
Oh, that's right. There was that Kickstarter to get that kickstarted.
Exactly. And now it's come to fruition, and time to play the game.
Yeah.
So, again, unless you have anything else, I think it might be time for some news.
Nope.
News. Oh my god, news.
Oh my god, blues. Clues.
So first on our news slate is that the Kadokawa Games game that had previously been announced as Project Code Tsukiyomi has been officially announced as God Wars Beyond Time for PS4 and Vita. So please look forward to more information about that. It is a tactical RPG, and it's going to feature more than 30 jobs, 200 weapons, and 600 skills, with character designs by Mino Taro, who is famous for the Love Plus series.
You know, I'm not a huge fan of Taro-san, but I am so excited for this game. 30 jobs, 200 weapons, 600 skills. Like, it's like a straight-up tactics-style RPG, which, you know, obviously a lot of us out there have a huge craving for. People, myself included, are constantly like, dude, Square Enix, why are you not making more games in the Final Fantasy Tactics mold? And
pretty
much. Looks like someone is finally stepping up, taking a very similar take on jobs and the way that, you know, skills and abilities work. I am beyond excited for this game, and I'm so happy that Kadokawa has already indicated that it will be releasing in North America at some point. So, you know, we just need to hold out for it, and this game should be releasing worldwide in 2016.
Yeah, and we also had some
PlayStation Vita.
Yeah, we also had some other news from Kadokawa, didn't we?
We did. Demon Gaze 2 has been announced for PlayStation Vita in 2016. The first Demon Gaze on Vita, I actually have it, and I actually liked it. It was pretty all right. It actually reminded me of a less good Persona, but it's still if your game can be compared to Persona and not be a complete poop pile, you're still doing pretty good.
Yeah, I think I remember hearing that comparison made.
Yeah.
And, more news from Kadokawa Games. This one is about The Legend of Heroes Trail in the Sky, the third evolution for Vita. So that keeps blazing a trail in the sky, that series.
And, you know, Trails in the Sky, second chapter recently came out. You know, it was a real labor of love getting that game even made and released in North America, so this is definitely something I'm excited about. I bet there are a lot of you out there excited, and let's all buy second chapter so that third evolution will come on over.
Steam is going to be getting a port of Dragon Quest Heroes, the World Tree as well, and the Light Below, which is going to be coming... Oh, it's available now. I didn't realize.
Well, so the game is available now on PlayStation 4. I don't believe it's available yet on the PC platform, but ads for it have been popping up on Steam. No date listed at this time, but, you know, this is definitely something to look forward to.
I was confused by this article. I was like, wait, is there a release date? Oh, immediately available for PlayStation 4.
Yeah, I have been playing this game somewhat recently. It's super fun, and I'm definitely stoked for more people to be able to play it.
Very cool.
We also have word here that Axis will be releasing Landgrisser Reincarnation Tensei in North America for the 3DS. The Landgrisser series was actually originally brought over to North America as War Song for the Sega Genesis back in 1991, but we haven't actually gotten much else Landgrisser released in North America, so this is very exciting. You know, a lot of people didn't think this game would be coming over. It is a little bit, how do you say, it's not exactly a looker. I think that maybe Kotaku would say it looks like dung, but it's, you know, the tactics are solid. I'm told that the story is pretty all right. And, you know, Landgrisser is German for lung ripper, so if that's not like the most metal thing you've ever heard, I don't know what is.
Cute! Speaking of themes that are simultaneously cute and super metal, we already knew that there will be a new Danganronpa V3 event happening on December 2nd. Well, now there's also going to be a special live stream countdown on November 24th on Nico Nico Live to commemorate the impending 5th anniversary of the Danganronpa series, which is on November 25th.
Oh, fantastic. Obviously, for those of you who are super excited, please remember New Danganronpa V3 is in development for PS4 and PlayStation Vita with a 2016 release in Target.
And other stores, too.
Oh gosh. And last, but certainly not least, for our follow-ups, we have word here that Nintendo Badge
Arcade... Oh, these aren't follow-ups.
Last but not least in our news this week, Nintendo Badge Arcade is officially available for download in North America and Europe. Badge Arcade, we talked about a little bit during its Japanese release. It is a free-to-play crane game that allows you to win badges to decorate your 3DS home screen with.
Yeah.
Now, the game is, it's tricky because, you know, it is a crane game, UFO Catcher.
I bet Seawolf Jason would be really good at it.
Probably. But also because you have to buy, with real cash money, individual plays to catch things. Now, the game, when you download it, does come with free plays, and everybody has the chance to earn additional free plays once per day by playing a practice catcher machine. It's pretty cool. You know, I've played this on my Japanese 3DS. I played it on my North American 3DS now. It's fun to catch things. It's super addictive when you, like, complete a set or whatever, but it can get pricey, so just be aware.
Yeah, and also people are all about that bunny.
Oh, yeah, there's a super cute bunny, and he's like the hostess of the arcade, and he talks a lot about, like, money, and he says, like, a lot of, like, straight-up truth tea about, like, people want content, well, they're going to have to pay for it. It's pretty amazing. He's talking about, and we have to charge money for this so that we can make money on it, so that we can continue developing new content for it. And it's just like, girl, I mean, no lies detected, but you just straight up said it. Damn. Anyway, the cool thing about this, of course, is that this this title was released on the eShop on November 10th, the same day that we found out that there would be a Nintendo Direct on November 12th. Obviously, this Nintendo Direct was preceded by much anticipation. There hadn't been a Nintendo Direct since E3. Obviously, you know, the passing of Satoru Iwata-san was a big deciding factor in the reason we went so long without a Direct. But, you know, I don't know that any other Direct has had quite so much hype to live up to.
Right.
Let's dig into how they did. So, the first big piece of news out of the Nintendo Direct was the confirmation of the long-rumored Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess HD.
Yep.
This will be releasing in North America on Wii U on March 4th, 2016. Additionally, there will be a version of the game that is sold with a new Wolf Link amiibo, which looks fantastic. And Nintendo confirmed that Wolf Link's amiibo data will somehow link up to the upcoming Legend of Zelda Wii U, coming in 2016. And Reggie Fiamme, on the American feed at least, on the North American feed, made a huge point of saying Legend of Zelda Wii U 2016 like five times.
Mm-hmm.
Like just over and over. He said, in fact, he only referred to it as Legend of Zelda for Wii U 2016. Like almost like Legend of Zelda for Wii U is like the title of the game or something. Now, I was just thinking, like, have we seen a console get three Zelda games in a while? Because that's about to happen here.
We haven't. And I mean, if you count Hyrule Warriors, that's really four.
Holy moly. Yeah, that's a really good point. So
watch, that means no NX Zelda.
Ah, that would be amazing. I would be so happy.
And then NX just gets all the Metroids.
Hey, man, that I would take that bet or that exchange. Who wouldn't? What do you think overall about this announcement, Slaggy?
You know, I think it's time again to let Twilight Princess get another moment. A Twilight Princess moment, a Wolf Link moment. We're having a Minna moment here.
So, you're trying to do this whole,
Mariah Carey thing.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of people saying that, you know, oh, it doesn't look that good. And then, like, I mean, you have to consider that Wind Waker HD was really well suited to, you know, its visual style was really well suited to an upgrade.
Yeah, Wind Waker was very well suited for an easy HD remaster that looked fantastic.
I mean, I think from what I've seen, it looks fine. And I think it's, like I said, it's been long enough that I'm like, okay, even if it was super derivative of Wind Waker in a lot of ways and, you know, was kind of just trying to be serious, Zelda, and like take a step away from Wind Waker, I'm ready to give it another try.
I will say I'm super excited to replay some of those later game dungeons. They were honestly some of my favorite Zelda experiences of the entire series. Like I would say probably the best designed like 3D Zelda dungeons in that game.
Yeah, so I think
it just sucks. There's so much crap you have to go through to get to them.
I just think that, you know, it's going to be interesting with some distance in between.
All right, all right. We obviously got...
Look at it through fresh eyes.
We obviously got...
Fresh wolf eyes.
That Zelda for Wii U is going to be a 2016 title. The next big news was that Splatoon was getting, and has now gotten in the past tense, a huge new update, including new maps, new outfits, new
40
weapons.
Pieces of gear.
Yeah, it was a big deal. Big content drop. Splatoon, obviously, surprise hit of the Wii U. And I just love, love, love seeing it continue to get supported. Just fantastic game. Totally deserves all of the love and attention it's got. We also have word here that a new 3DS game will be coming to the 3DS eShop. This is going to be Pokemon Picross. It is a free-to-start downloadable game. Free-to-start, of course, is Nintendo's new terminology for their free-to-play games, where typically you can play the game and start at no cost. You know, the first hit is free, but you pay for each additional hit. Basically, Nintendo is now dealing electronic drugs.
Well, and Picross is your favorite.
Yeah, I'm super, super stoked. I love Picross. I love Pokemon. This is, like, designed to get me hooked. We also have word here that Pokken Tournament will be releasing for North American Wii U's in the spring of 2016.
That's
the
exciting.
First production run of the game will include a Shadow Mewtwo amiibo card that will allow you to unlock him as a playable character immediately rather than needing to play through the game on hard or whatever nonsense they're going to come up with to make him an unlockable for people without the amiibo card.
Yeah, I was just thinking, man, Pokemon amiibo cards, like, because I'm sure they would not release a whole line of 800 plus Pokemon amiibo, because that would just be, like, unrealistic. But amiibo cards for Pokemon, especially if they, like, tied into the Pokemon trading card game, like...
And hey, man, I'm telling you, this is the first step to that. We now have a Pokemon amiibo card. You think it's going to be the only one?
Hell no.
We also have word here that Star Fox Zero has finally gotten its new release date. You may recall this was originally supposed to be hitting in December of 2015, which obviously would be just a few weeks away now. It's now going to be releasing on April 22nd, 2016.
That's good.
And the new trailer they showed has already shown some marked visual improvement in the game's appearance. Many people were complaining previously that the game looked too last gen to be excited about. Well, the game now looks as good as the concept sounds, because to me, I'm super excited about this game and the concept of, like, you know, your ship and the city around you is going to be on your TV. You're going to have on the Wii U gamepad, like, yeah, a cockpit view. I think that's a neat concept. I'm very excited to see if they can pull it off. We also have word here that Mario & Luigi Paper Jam will be coming to the 3DS on January 22nd, 2016.
That's awesome.
This is obviously the crossover game of the Mario & Luigi RPG series, as well as the Paper Mario series. I'm super, super, super looking forward to it, and hopefully it turns out amazing.
Yes.
We also have word that the Mega Man Legacy Collection will be coming out on 3DS in North America on February 23rd, and that there will be a limited edition package that comes with a gold Mega Man amiibo.
Cool.
Additionally, we finally found out how Nintendo will be handling the multi-part release of the new Fire Emblem game. You will have the option of buying Fire Emblem Fates Birthright or Fire Emblem Fates Conquest in stores or electronically from the eShop for $39.99, the standard 3DS game price. And then you'll be able to buy the other game in the series as a digital add-on for $20. And then after that, if you finish both games, there will be a third game available, that is Fire Emblem Fates Revelation, which will not be available as a retail release. That will be another digital add-on available for $20. So there's also going to be a special edition, which is the same price effectively as buying one game and then buying the other two digitally. That is going to be a $79.99 manufacturer suggested retail price. It includes Fire Emblem Fates Birthright, Fire Emblem Fates Conquest, Fire Emblem Fates Revelation, a hardback art book, and a new 3DS XL carrying pouch.
Cool. What I'm a little confused about is that presumably it'll be like a special code to redeem once Revelation is actually released.
It's possible. I got the impression from watching the Direct that they were all going to be, like, on the same cartridge, but maybe it is multiple cartridges with a code to download. I guess I don't really know.
Yeah, we'll have to see.
Indeed. We also, and this was a huge deal, had a new character announced for Hyrule Warriors.
Yes!
This is Linkle, and she is a female version of Link. She is going to be a highly agile, dual crossbow-wielding adventurer. Basically, watching the reveal trailer for her, she's like on her back doing spin kicks and shooting dudes with her double-fisted crossbows. I'm like, this bitch is Bayonetta right now.
Yes.
I am super living for it. She is fierce as hell, and already there are cries all across the internet that she needs to be in more games.
Well,
and all I can say is, hell yes.
Could you imagine if she was the hero in Zelda for Wii U 2016?
I mean, that could...
Or even just give us the option to be Link or Linkle from now on, please.
That is something I would love, you know, since most of the Zelda games don't really, like, focus super, super, super deep on, like, character background
or
story.
And all you would have to do is replace some sound files with,
You don't even need to do that. Like, I think that Link's voice could easily be presenting male or presenting female. I don't even think you need to make that many changes at all. Either way, we will continue to report on Linkle assuming there is more information about Linkle, so let's keep our fingers crossed there. Other gigantic news is confirmation that the Dragon Quest 3DS games are finally coming to North America. This is going to be Dragon Quest VII and Dragon Quest VIII, both releasing on the 3DS in English in 2016.
Yeah, that's a huge deal.
Right? People have been crying for these two games to come to North America for years now. So to see it finally confirmed, finally announced, is just absolutely fantastic news. You know, obviously we here at GameBuie.org have been reporting every reliable rumor about these games coming to North America that we've heard over the last year or so. So I'm not strictly super, super surprised that this happened, but I'm so happy that it's finally official. Just absolutely fantastic news. I'm going to buy both games, and I encourage anyone out there to do the same. We also have word that Pokemon Red, Pokemon Blue, and Pokemon Yellow will be releasing as virtual console titles on the 3DS.
That's so cool.
It's super cool. They are going to have online functionality, well, local functionality for multiplayer, so that you'll basically be able to do all the link cable stuff just wirelessly with your other friends playing these games on Virtual Console. There will not be internet functionalities added, but chances are, if you know people who have 3DS, they're probably going to be playing one of these games at some point. So have fun, and if I see you at a convention or anything, you know, please play Pokemon with me, because you know I'll be all about these.
Yeah. It's going to be hard to choose. I mean, I'll end up just buying all of them probably, but I mean, Yellow is kind of the one that's near and dear to my heart, so that'll probably be the most likely one. You know, you got all three of the starters, too, and, you know, it has the better art, so...
Yeah, super, super, super stoked. That's probably the one I'll play, too, so... Anyway, the last big news of the North American Nintendo Direct was a new Smash Brothers character announced. This is obviously DLC. It will be coming at a later date. I expect we'll hear more information about it at the upcoming Super Smash Brothers special presentation for December. So who is this, question you might be asking? Well, it is none other than a Final Fantasy representative. Soon, everywhere you turn online, you will be seeing players playing as Cloud Strife from Final Fantasy VII.
What?
Yeah, this is a pretty
big deal. The collective
sound
of fanboys everywhere having fangasms.
Yeah, right? I mean, we were all losing our shit when this trailer started. You know, I had one window playing the Direct. I had one window on Twitter. My Twitter just blew up with, like, WTF, OMG, WTH. Like, it was crazy pants moment, for real. Either way, Cloud's moveset, based on the trailer we saw of him, you know, it looks well-suited for the game. Super, super, super fanservice-y in terms of having, like, a lot of content that is, like, very Final Fantasy VII appropriate.
Do you think one of his costumes is going to be the Honey Bee Inn?
Okay, so the one alternate costume we have already seen is the Advent Children costume.
Right.
There's already a lot of people wondering what other alternate costumes we're going to get. A lot of us are hoping for a Kingdom Hearts Cloud costume.
Oh, that one makes sense.
And, you know, I doubt there will be a Honey Bee Inn costume, but crazier things have happened. We literally have a Shulk in his boxer shorts skin and Zero Suit Samus in a bikini. So crazier things have happened, I guess.
True.
Either way, we don't know a whole lot yet. The trailer is fantastic. If you haven't seen it yet, I highly, 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 highly recommend it. And expect us to be talking more about this in December.
Yes.
And I just have to say, you know, I don't want to, like, overhype the special Smash Brothers presentation in December. But if Cloud is our teaser, like, do you think there are going to be even more Megatons drop next month?
I can only wonder.
Right? Like, I feel like it's not really Nintendo's style with promoting Smash to, like, drop the big bombs first. So
yeah, I mean, who else could there be?
Please look forward to it. Hey, man, I'm still on the fence of hoping for Bayonetta or Bomberman.
It's just Linkle.
Hey, you say just Linkle, but I'd be so stoked to have Linkle in Smash.
Yeah.
God damn it, Nintendo. Linkle in Smash.
Linkle in all the things.
We also have word here in the Japanese Nintendo Direct, of a new sequel in the much-loved and long-lived Coldcept series. This is Coldcept Revolt, and it has been announced for a Japanese release in 2016. And I'm just going to start now, like, please, 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 Exceed or someone, bring Coldcept Revolt to North America. Thanks.
Thanks.
And last but...
And more Linkle.
Last but certainly not least, we also had an announcement from the Japanese Nintendo Direct that Mother 3 will be coming to the Wii U Virtual Console in Japan.
Yeah.
You know, some people are super salty about this, but I view it as a good thing. I think that it's a good step to see Mother 3 get any kind of support because, you know, the Mother games have not really been getting, like, digital releases as much as you would think, anyway, in Japan. Mother 3 in particular, like, I'm surprised it took this long. So I'm just happy to see it get some love, and I'm super, 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 super hopeful that someday it will see release in North America. I believe someday we will see Mother 3 get a release.
I mean, Earthbound Beginning, so.
Well, exactly. So I'm just going to keep my fingers crossed. I'm going to keep my thoughts positive, and I'm just going to keep hoping.
I think we'll see Mother 3 at some point. Crazier things have happened. Cloud Strife is in Smash Brothers, along with Sonic, Pac-Man, and Ryu.
Right? Shenmue 3's getting made. Final Fantasy 7's getting a remake. The Last Guardian is still alive.
What is this world we live in?
Right? I don't even know anymore. So we also have some Smashes.
Yeah, it's a world where Keiji Inafune is kind of not in the best situation, isn't it?
Yeah, so this was an extended interview with Keiji Inafune that we want to shout out to this week. You know, our Smash section is where we talk about, like, some of our favorite news articles in games journalism of the last few weeks. This is a two-part interview between Jeremy Parrish and Keiji Inafune-san. The first one is The Whys and Wherefores of Mighty No. 9, where he talks specifically about kickstarting Mighty No. 9, about the development process, including talking a little bit about the delays and some of the, you know, multimedia partnerships they've made. It's a really great read. But even better, it leads into the failure and fortunes of Red Ash. This is part two of the interview, and Keiji Inafune-san and Jeremy Parrish talk specifically about the Mighty No. 9 spin-off Kickstarter for Red Ash, which, as you may recall, actually failed. So this is kind of a hot topic for a minute, and it's interesting to finally see some straight, real talk.
Yeah.
Spilling the tea from Inafune-san about, you know, what happened. So it's a great read, lots of, you know, just really good interview questions asked. Definitely the kind of thing that deserves your clicks. We'll link it to you over at GameBuie.org.
GameBuie.org.
That was over on US Gamer, and it is just absolutely an article you should check out.
Yeah, like you said, finally nice to see Inafune speaking honestly about this stuff. Because I think that was the big thing that people were salty about, was that there wasn't a lot of transparency to the point where they were, like, thinking that he was just going to take the money and run.
Yeah, well, you know, with Kickstarter,
like that Steve Miller band song, The Joker.
There's always someone who thinks that the money is going to be grabbed and ran. But I didn't think Inafune-san was going to do it like that. I had my doubts at some points over whether he was really going to deliver the game or in a satisfactory state. It's clear to me now he definitely is, and that's cool, but I just feel like he had a lot to answer for, and I think this interview is kind of the first step in the right direction in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So, with all that having been said, it's time for us to have our discussion. All right, well, if you heard that we were doing an episode on the history of Nintendo, and you thought that the word big and britches came to mind, you're not alone in that. But, you know, we are doing our Ninty 90s here, and it occurred that, to the degree that we can, you know, I've done a lot of reading on the history of Nintendo, I know Slaggy has done a lot of reading, and we really wanted to include a sort of historical look at the beginnings of Nintendo. You know, we often talk about how Nintendo was founded, you know, over 100 years ago, how they've been in the game for as long as there has been a game, as far as, you know, games anyway. So, you know, we just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, how this small Japanese company, founded in 1889 by Fusajiro Yamauchi-san, you know, making Hanafune cards, became one of the preeminent forces in, you know, gaming. I mean, it's huge. Nintendo is so influential. They have left such an indelible mark on interactive electronic entertainment. And I just absolutely think it's fascinating that they are, you know, a historical company. They've been around for more than 100 years.
Yep.
So, Asai, what are your thoughts before we get into the details?
I just remember, like, you know, I want to say the first time I found out about this was, I want to say it was pre-internet, so I can't say that for sure, but, like, I feel like it was kind of something that the company would acknowledge in bits and pieces, like in, like, Nintendo Power or something, being like, or in just other gaming magazines, like, oh, Nintendo started out
selling playing cards.
And so I was always like, whoa. I mean, it could have been on the internet that I first read it, but, you know.
Well, I definitely saw it referenced in the pages of Electronic Gaming Monthly.
Right, that's why I feel like it was earlier for me, too.
Yeah, like, they definitely talked about it in some of the gaming mags. Possibly Nintendo Power. I couldn't say that authoritatively, though. But definitely some of the other non-Nintendo affiliated ones
right.
would reference it as a 100-year-old company.
And so I always just thought, like, whoa.
You know, I want to say one of the books here that is just absolutely invaluable if you really want to talk about the history of Nintendo, quite specifically, is a French book published by Picks and Love Publishing. It is called The History of Nintendo. I only have volume one of it, but it's super good. Volume 2 is specifically about the Game & Watch, and that was a little less important for this discussion. I did not order it, but you can get it off Amazon for, it's like $30 or something. It is a fantastic read, and, you know, there's a lot to it. It really talks about some details of Nintendo's history that I wasn't super, super familiar with before. Although, I will say, in putting together my show notes for this episode, at this point, you know, even like the Wikipedias are starting to get a lot of information on Nintendo that previously was not super common knowledge. So it's a very cool time to be interested in this sort of thing. So, you know, I want to start off with the first thing here, which is that, you know, we often think of Nintendo, the name, to mean leave luck to heaven. But that's actually not, strictly speaking, necessarily like the most straightforward forward translation.
Right.
And it's funny because there's actually a whole passage about this in the history of Nintendo that I thought was fascinating. You know, the Leave Luck to Heaven translation is something that Yamauchi-san, Hiroshi Yamauchi, who was the Yamauchi great-grandson of the company's founder, and who was obviously a huge part of Nintendo in our lifetimes.
Right.
Making all the big shots from, you know, the NES era up to the GameCube era, I want to say.
Yep.
And he was the one who gave, you know, to leave one's fortune in the hands of fate, or, you know, leave luck to heaven, as a plausible explanation. But you could also make an argument that the name Nintendo means something like the Temple of Free Hanafuda, or, you know, a company that is allowed to make Hanafuda. So, you know, it's just really interesting that we have all taken Nintendo like straight up to mean leave luck to heaven, but there's literally no historical record that backs that up.
But it let us make our Halloween episode called Leave Luck to Hell, so we're running with it.
Yeah, right.
At this point, you know, it's so much associated that, you know, it's kind of just, I don't want to say like a trademark, but, you know, it's easy to associate that phrase.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And so, basically, Nintendo, at the time known as Nintendo Koppai, was founded September 23rd, 1989
Welcome to New York.
By Fusajiro Yamauchi-san. All of their Hanafuda cards were handmade and actually very quickly became very popular. Yamauchi went from being like a single-man operation to having a whole staff of people under him, even within those first couple years. Unfortunately, Fusajiro Yamauchi did not have any sons to leave the family business to him. So following common Japanese tradition, he actually adopted his son-in-law after, this would be Sekiryo Yamauchi-san, who married Fusajiro's daughter. And in 1929, Fusajiro-san retired from the company, allowed Sekiryo to take over the company as president. In 1933, Sekiryo established a joint venture with another company and renamed the company Yamauchi Nintendo and Co. You know, they kept at the Hanafuda for quite some time, actually. And in fact, even to this day, we do see Nintendo producing Hanafuda cards in some limited property.
And can we take a quick sidebar to those who maybe aren't familiar with what Hanafuda cards are?
On this show? Really?
I'm just saying, maybe, so let's not judge.
Have at. You just said you wanted to take a sidebar. Take a sidebar.
I wanted you to explain because you're more familiar with Japanese card games. I feel like I wouldn't be able to explain it quite as well.
Oh, so you're going to make a stink, and then you're not going to do the damn work yourself.
Rude.
I'm rude? I mean, it's a Japanese card game. I mean, the problem with explaining something like Hanafuda is that it's such a complex game. It would be similar to explaining something like Mahjong over a conversation. Like, okay, writ large, Mahjong is about matching tiles, taking tiles, sticking tiles, you know, depending on what variant of the game you're playing. Hanafuda is, at its core, about 12 suits of cards representing months. You have different cards within each month representing different types of flowers. The flowers are worth different amounts of points depending on what's depicted on them, if they're like a special card or a ribbon card or a normal card. And, you know, you're basically trying to play in order to, you know, get the most high value cards possible. So you're trying to get like the special card from a given month, or you're trying to get the ribbon card from a given month. And I mean, I literally wouldn't know how to explain how to play it, though.
I think that was pretty good.
Okay, so in 1947, they then established a distribution company. This is Marufuku Co. .ltd, to distribute Hanafuda cards made by Nintendo, as well as other card games that at this point Nintendo was beginning to branch out into producing. So, you know, we already see in 1947, Nintendo has this whole growth operation of, you know, expanding into, like, emergent fields and just really getting involved in the production of other games and toys. And the reason I bring that up is because in the next 10 years or so from here, we start to see Nintendo experiment a little bit in their business fields.
Yeah, and like really goes from there.
We sort of saw Nintendo start trying, and I say we, I want to make it clear I was not alive at this time, but historically we understand Marufuku Co.Ltd. became Nintendo Playing Card in 1951. In 1953, Nintendo became the first company in Japan to produce playing cards from plastic. In 1956, Hiroshi Yamauchi, who is, of course, the same Hiroshi Yamauchi who took over Nintendo, became their CEO or whatever, and was their CEO through, you know, the birth of their electronic games stuff.
And that was,
you see him come on the screen, on the scene.
That was Sekiryo-san's child, correct? Hiroshi?
Yeah.
And the thing that I thought was interesting is that Sekiryo-san also adopted his son-in-law.
Well, that's, again, that was something.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That used
so
to be done
Sekiryo-san would have been Hiroshi's
grandfather.
Grandfather, yeah. There we go.
Yes. And Sekiryo's son-in-law, sure. Shikanojo Inaba-san, who was renamed to Shikanojo Yamauchi, his son, Hiroshi, is the Hiroshi Yamauchi whom
yes.
we are familiar with. And Hiroshi actually took over the company rather than his father, Shikanojo. And this is largely because Shikanojo actually left his family. Hiroshi was brought up by his grandparents, specifically Sekiryo-san. So, obviously, you know, Hiroshi was all lined up to take over Nintendo. Little bit of drama there. You don't actually see that kind of drama in a lot of these company men's lives historically. So it's interesting to think, you know, we often think about how Hiroshi Yamauchi was a non-traditional Japanese leader for the company as far as like making some, let's just say, surprising choices. Obviously, his chosen successor, Satoru Iwata-san, whom we will not be talking about a whole lot today, was also a little bit of a maverick making non-traditional choices. So it's interesting to me that Hiroshi Yamauchi-san has this sort of non-traditional background for a man of his position.
Yeah, and I mean, that really led to Nintendo, like you said, expanding beyond Hanafuda cards.
Well, absolutely. And that's actually specifically because, funny enough, you know, I had mentioned that in 1956, Hiroshi Yamauchi visited the U.S. to engage talks with the United States Playing Card Company, which is what I was, you know, starting to talk about before we got sidetracked. Yamauchi was surprised to see that the United States Playing Card Company, the dominant playing card manufacturer of the United States, had a really tiny little office in some corporate building somewhere.
Yeah.
And for Yamauchi, that was like an eye-opening moment, because that was when he accepted that the playing card business had a hard limit on how big it was ever going to grow for Nintendo.
Yeah.
So in 1959, Nintendo started working with Disney
yes.
to allow Nintendo to use Disney characters on Nintendo's playing cards. So, you know, previously, you would see playing cards used as like a gambling device. And especially in Japan, you know, you'd see Western cards being used as straight up like, oh, these are only present in casinos and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And Nintendo decided that by using Disney on their cards, they could sell the products to Japanese families. And, you know, they started to sell, you know, more than half a million card packs a year, which was for them a huge growth. Resultantly, by 1962, Yamauchi had led Nintendo to such success that they were able to open up the company to the public and list the company on the Osaka Stock Exchange. Only second division at the time, but still, it's a huge step for a growing business. After that, of course, Nintendo Playing Card Co. Ltd. was renamed to Nintendo Co. Ltd. by Hiroshi-san, and Nintendo began to experiment in other areas of business altogether.
This is my favorite.
Using all of that money that they made off of, you know, their Disney cards, basically. You know, Nintendo set up a taxi company. They set up a food company selling instant rice, you know,
what
which
about
is
the love
theoretically
hotels?
Similar to instant noodles. I'm saving the best for last. Jesus. They made a vacuum cleaner, which has appeared in WarioWare. That was the Chiritori
yeah.
vacuum. And Saigi, why don't you say that again?
And they tried to open a chain of love hotels,
which basically do what they say on the tin. You know, but they also, among all of this stuff, started making more diverse toys. And all of these other ventures actually failed pretty hard. But toy making, you know, they already had experience from selling their playing cards, designing cards. You know, they actually were able to get a foot in the door for toy making. Japan was in the middle of an economic boom due to the Tokyo Olympics of the time in 1964. And, you know, the playing card business ended up reaching saturation point, which is awful news. People basically stopped buying playing cards altogether, and Nintendo's stock fell down to under the U.S. equivalent of like 50 cents a share.
Ugh.
Right? So, fortunately, you know, Yamauchi-san had a real eye for talent, and in 1965, they hired Gunpei Yokoi
yep.
as a maintenance engineer for the assembly line. It's funny because, you know, they brought him on board to fix conveyor belts and, you know, just be like a grease monkey, and he
yeah.
ended up becoming like one of the big developers
he was
and
arguably,
designers of Nintendo.
He was arguably the company's first Game Boy.
You tried and succeeded. So, you know, at this point, Nintendo had actually racked up a big amount of debt, like actual debt, which obviously
yeah,
in the modern age...
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, in the modern age, a lot of people look at Nintendo like, oh, they were in the red once for like three quarters. Like, no, in terms of the history of a business, a few quarters in the red is not the end of the world, especially not a gigantic corporation that has tons of assets.
Yeah.
Which Nintendo does. You know, it's a well-known, well-documented fact. Nintendo has more assets than basically any other company in gaming, if you really want to get into it.
Yeah.
So, at this point, though, they did not have these assets. And, you know, riddled with real debt, Nintendo was struggling even to survive on their last remaining leg of their business, which was the toy making.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of a big risk.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the toy industry was already dominated by companies that are still alive today, stuff like Bandai and Tomy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because toys are generally only popular for a little while, they become a fad and then they burn out and nobody wants them. Nintendo was feeling the burn, needing to constantly come up with new products. Now, something that was interesting was that in 1966, Hiroshi Yamauchi-san, was observing the Hanafuda factory, the Nintendo Hanafuda factory, and he noticed that Gunpei Yokoi, one of their maintenance engineers, had actually made himself like a toy, like extendable grabby hand. You may have seen these. They were actually kind of popular. Even when I was a kid, like
yeah.
these reachy grabby hands were still fairly popular. And Yamauchi-san saw Yokoi-san like playing with this extendable hand, and Yamauchi was immediately like, we need to have this mass produced as a toy right meow. Like, we need to hit the Christmas rush of the current year and get this thing sold.
And just that just shows, like, you know, I really feel the start of Nintendo fostering creative out-of-the-box thinkers. Instead of a company that'd be like, stop playing around with that gadget and get back to work, Yokoi.
You're wasting company time. Like, no. Yamauchi-san was like, this is amazing. We can sell this.
And thus the Ultra Hand was born.
Well, yep, that was the Ultra Hand. It was one of Nintendo's, it's considered one of Nintendo's earliest blockbusters, selling more than 1 million units that holiday season, which is nuts.
More than the Vita's ever sold. No, I'm kidding.
Ah, that's not true, but it's hilarious. Yamauchi-san pulled Yokoi off of assembly line work immediately and promoted him from maintenance to product development. And Gunpei Yokoi-san actually had an electrical engineering background. So almost immediately, you know, he began working on developing electronic toys. And Nintendo realized, you know, these electronic toys captured people's attention in a way that stuff like even the Ultra Hand, which was a huge fad, super popular on its release. But these electronic toys held people's attention for longer. And as a result, Nintendo could charge a premium price for them, which obviously higher price margins, you're a business, that's what you want. So Yokoi started making stuff like, puzzle barrel games, like little electronic games, like one of those little like baseball throwing machines. They made like love testers that like
perfect
those,
for the Love Hotel,
like those things you see in bars where you both put your finger on it. It's like the love tester.
Or the ones where it's like, what level are you? Are you a stud or a dud?
Right, but it's like that kind of stuff.
I'm a dud.
And in collaboration with a gentleman from Sharp, that is Masayuki Uemura-san, Yokoi-san developed the Nintendo Beam Gun game. This was a solar-powered light gun, and it was the first available light gun for home use. And it was actually like the precursor to the NES Zapper, basically.
Yep.
That was in 1970. So, you know, some of these big ground, some of this big ground that Nintendo's breaking is even still, you know, nearly 15 years before they were going to change the world with the NES/Famicom systems.
Yeah, and I always think that, you know, the Beam Gun has a really interesting, you know, kind of series of development.
Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
I mean, if you're trying to go in chronological order here, I don't want to jump ahead.
Oh, no, but you can go off on your diversion. Do it, man.
Well, I mean, you know, then they ended up doing laser clay shooting and then making all these light gun games. There was actually, I want to say around 75, 76, they had a game called Duck Hunt. So Duck Hunt actually was one of these light gun games before it was even an NES game, which I think some, like a lot of people maybe weren't aware of that. If they're not aware of this history, they just thought, oh, Duck Hunt, you know, was on NES, but it actually had its roots in the 70s, along with the clay shooting, which is which makes a lot of sense to learn that, you know, when you're like, why was there clay shooting in Duck Hunt? Why was that a mode? Because, I mean, it was a callback to the successes that Nintendo had, and it makes a lot more sense now, and, you know, why they put those together and why that game was such a success.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That was a good digression. Back to the chronological, though. In 1972, Nintendo released the Elekonga.
Elekonga.
And this is actually a programmable drum machine that is considered, like, one of the first real programmable drum machines.
That's cool.
It could play pre-programmed rhythms using punch cards, and they actually released all the information to alter these punch cards by the user in order to play different musical patterns.
We should get an Elekonga and make an Elekonga band.
Oh my gosh, we should get an Elekonga and use it to make music for the show for our new bumpers.
We should.
Ah! Obviously, you know, in 1972, the first commercially available video game console actually released the light gun accessory. That was the Magnavox Odyssey.
Yep.
And it had the shooting gallery. And this was something that Nintendo worked with Magnavox on, using the sort of the same technology as the laser clay shooting series that Sidekick was talking about. And in 1974, Nintendo actually secured the rights to distribute the Odyssey in Japan.
Yep.
So that's sort of where you see video game consoles, you know, starting, Nintendo starting to get involved in video game consoles rather than just, you know, like video game boxes. Some connect to your TV, some just display on like your wall or whatever. There's some weird tech that Nintendo dabbled in.
You have to realize this was
the 70s.
Yeah, and this was even before Atari's heyday with Pong and the 2600 and everything, you know, so, I mean, Nintendo really getting in the game early.
Well, absolutely, and, you know, after this point, Nintendo started to develop its own video games at this
color
point.
TV game.
Both for homes and for arcades. You know, they worked with Mitsubishi Electric on the color TV game machine. Color TV game machine actually got some love in the Super Smash Brothers for 3DS and Wii.
Yeah.
And it's just just, it's a really cool part of Nintendo's history. The Color TV Game 6 and Color TV Game 15, each of which indicated the number of games on board these little devices that would, you know, connect to TVs.
And most of them, I believe, were, like, versions of, like, tennis or Pong.
Yeah, it was all super basic stuff, you know. We're not sitting here saying this was Dragon Quest or nothing. But, you know, stuff like Pong, tennis, you know, we started to see them do, like, little basic shooty bits. Their first arcade video game, though, was 1975's EVR Race. And that was, you know, like a racer game. We saw Radar Scope coming a little bit after that. And finally, Donkey Kong.
Yep.
And, you know, we've talked a little bit about Donkey Kong. 1981, Shigeru Miyamoto-san designed it, and that was released in arcades and on the Atari 2600, Intellivision, and ColecoVision
yep.
video game systems that all came prior to the Famicom. Nintendo themselves generally had very, very little involvement in the production of these ports.
Yeah, some of the ports were really terrible.
Oh, yeah, some of them were.
I feel like the ColecoVision was, like, regarded as the best one.
I believe that that's a true statement.
Yeah, and I feel like we're going to give DK his day at some point.
We're going to have to give DK his day.
He's a hell of an ape.
Well, he is, in fact, a hell of an ape. So, you know, that brings us up to the beginning of the console era. And, you know, we saw Nintendo start testing the waters for handheld video games. We saw the Game & Watch.
Yep, and that was Gunpei Yokoi-san.
That was developed by Gunpei Yokoi, and they continued producing these things in their original run from 1981 to 1991.
Yeah, I even remember seeing them. I didn't personally have any, but I did have the Game Watches, which were a little different. I think that was just like Tiger was involved in those.
I believe you're right. The Game & Watch stuff, you know, they actually sold like 43.5 million units worldwide and was considered to be Nintendo's first like smash hit, which when you think about it in context really explains why, you know, doesn't explain why, but is a piece of why Nintendo really went all in on video games, because their yep. biggest success was a Game & Watch. I mean,
yeah,
if you've played one of those things, they're pretty cool, but you have to figure, man, developing that thing and then selling 43.5 million units, like, that has to be a good, there has to be a good return on that investment. Like,
yeah.
So,
and I just always think it's super cute that, you know, we see the DS form factor appearing that early on.
Oh, absolutely. That clamshell design.
And again, like, just with, like, with Duck Hunt, the way that Nintendo does these callbacks and appreciates their history like that.
Well, and, you know, you say that, and we've talked about that here on the show, you know, the Miis were initially an idea they had even as far as the Famicom days.
Right.
That they could never properly implement until the Wii era.
And so people just thought, oh, it was some Wii gimmick for waggleware, blah.
One of the coolest things to me about Nintendo, and I say this as a huge Nintendo fan, is the way that they never let a good idea die.
Yeah.
They will find ways to iterate on it, to make it more interesting, to experiment on it and do new things. And 9 times out of 10, I would say we all hugely benefit from that willingness to experiment and to not drop good ideas. Anyway, though, I digress. In 1982, that is, Nintendo developed a prototype console of their own called the Advanced Video System.
Oh, yeah.
This was a little bit like the form factor of a computer meets a console. It was never released, but you can see a display unit at the Nintendo World Store in New York.
Oh,
I've
that's
been
so
there.
Cool.
I've seen it. It is so rad.
I want to go to there.
In 1983, Nintendo released in Japan the Famicom. This is the family computer system.
Oh, no big deal. Just a little plastic box for games.
Was released in Japan. It was their first attempt at a cartridge-based video game console, similar to what you saw coming out of, you know, the Atari, Intellivision, ColecoVision type stuff. And the system in Japan sold over 500,000 units in 2 months with a price of around $100 American at the time. So, you know, basically, the Famicom, it was a huge success right out of the gate, except that, unfortunately, there was a design flaw that, due to a malfunctioning chip, that Nintendo actually recalled all of those launch Famicom units.
Aww.
Which actually cost them a huge amount of money at the time, and this is in, you know, 1983 dollars, the equivalent of $500,000 US dollars.
Ouch.
which is, yeah, just horrifying. But during this experience, you know, Nintendo decided that the best way to recoup this money would be to release the Famicom in the U.S. You know, they had no real experience with U.S. marketplace, though, so they actually tried to work out a contract with Atari to distribute an American version of the Famicom in 1983. But, you know, they had Atari had just had a kerfuffle with Coleco. You know, they had drama with Nintendo over Donkey Kong and Nintendo not being super happy with how the Atari port went. So basically Atari refused to back Nintendo's console. And then, you know, the great video game crash of 1983 happened later that same year. So basically the entire American video games market was non-existent. And Nintendo, you know, left to their own devices, actually gave them a really bad starting point because there was no one they could work with to release in North America. But it was also a tremendous opportunity because they had the distance from the situation to see how the games market crashed, see what mistakes Atari and Coleco and, you know, everyone had made, and basically they could control their console and make better choices to not crash the system, but to, you know, rebuild the market, so to speak.
Yep.
And this is actually why the Nintendo Seal of Quality exists. Now,
and the five-game unit.
Well, hold on, girl.
The five-game limit, sorry.
Hold on, girl. We're going to get there. One of Nintendo's perceived issues in why the market crashed, and, you know, this is fact. We've talked about this here on the show before, is that there was just a huge marketplace just filled with a glut of trash games. Everyone was releasing games. Some of them didn't even work right. Like, they were just this rubbish, like, one-screen, very basic mechanic. Just poor games. People would buy one game and never buy another one because it was just, they were all the same. They were all awful, basically. And basically Nintendo looked at this situation, was like, you know, the problem here is too many games are being released, not enough work is going into the individual games. You know, we even have, like, some of the best games of that early era. You have stuff like Adventure, where people are like, oh, we made that in 3 months. And it's just like, well, you know, Nintendo basically was like, we're going to do this Seal of Quality thing. You're going to have to get a license from us to release games on our hardware. We're going to have chips in the hardware so that you can't make, like, rogue, like, games that aren't licensed by us, and you're only going to be able to release, you know, five games in a single year. And basically Nintendo worked really hard to set up a market condition where the Nintendo Entertainment System could be successful when it released in 1985, in order to sort of go under the radar. You know, the media in North America was super, super heavy-handed on games at the time. Games were considered a waste of time. They were, you know, not worth the plastic being used to produce them. So Nintendo released the NES with Rob, the robotic operating buddy. And we've talked about Rob, and we've even talked a little bit about his place in this production. You know, the Rob was created so that Nintendo could sell the Nintendo Entertainment System not as a video game console, but as a toy, so that they could sell it alongside, like, the Teddy Ruxpin, you know, that little talking bear that interacted with cassette tapes. So, and, you know, this actually worked to some degree. Nintendo, ultimately, the Rob was only supported with, what, like, two games?
Yeah.
But, you know, they also shipped it with the light gun, so it was seen not as a video game, per se, but an entertainment system.
A Nintendo Entertainment System.
That's the joke. So, you know, we did ultimately see companies work around some of Nintendo's restrictive policies. Konami, for example, created a subsidiary, Ultra Games, so that they could release more than five games in one period. Ultra Games, funny enough, actually released some of probably your childhood favorite Konami games. You know, Ultra was responsible for the publication of Metal Gear, Skate or Die, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yep.
So, you know, like, some real, like, winners at the time. Stuff like Operation C, the Game Boy-based Contra sequel. So, just really interesting that, you know, these games were released by Konami through this subsidiary to get around this limitation.
Yeah.
The other big hit and the other big reason why the NES / Famicom was so successful worldwide is that in 1985, Super Mario Brothers was released for the Famicom in Japan and was a breakaway hit.
Oh, if only we had done an episode about that.
All right. And we have, and that's sort of where we leave the NES talk.
Yeah.
Since we're now getting to the point where we've talked about a lot of this stuff, you know, the Game Boy era and the Super Nintendo Entertainment System era, we just talked about that. If you want to hear us talk about the Super Nintendo Entertainment System, we did an episode on it. you want to hear us talk about the Nintendo 64, which, you know, the Nintendo 64 era started in 1996. We've done an episode on that.
Yeah.
The GameCube. Did we do a GameCube episode?
We haven't, but we... I'm sure we will. I mean, it's got an anniversary coming next year, so...
Oh, that turns 15 next year.
It does, so I think... I mean, I love the GameCube.
Well, let's clock it. We're going to talk about the GameCube next year.
Yeah,
but...
I mean, in terms of business, though, you know, that was the era where, as we talked about, you know, we kind of talked about, like you said, Iwata-san... in memoriam of him, but you know, this was the era where he succeeded Hiroshi Yamauchi-san as the president, and you know, the Nintendo that we've come to know in the last 15 years and continue to innovate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the DS and the Wii is also turning 10 next year, so big year for Nintendo anniversaries.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's exciting for us because that gives us fodder to talk about.
Exactly, and you know, we are living the 3DS and Wii U years now, and.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you do want to hear us talk about the Wii, you know, when the Wii U launched and we said goodbye to the Wii, we did do a farewell Wii episode.
We did, yeah.
So you can definitely hear some us talk about the Wii sort of immediately after its life. I don't know that we've really looked at it historically yet, though. So
yeah.
It's going to be time to sit down and do a little bit of reading on that point.
And, you know, where I kind of would like to take this, unless you have any other points to touch on in regards to their recent history... is that, you know, we're starting to see them move towards the quality of life division. And I just think that's really interesting because it's almost like a step back to not, you know, love hotels or love testers, but we're finally starting to see them, you know, despite the opinion some people have that Nintendo's a failure, blah, 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 the Wii U is going to doom them and they're going to have to quit gaming forever. Like you said, they're actually doing really well in terms of their assets. I mean, to the point where they're so stable that they can... afford to explore these things. You know, we've got that like sleep device thing or sleep tracker that they're working on.
Well, but let's take a step back because, first off, the reason the Wii was so brilliantly successful, and I'm tying this directly to what you're saying right now, Saggy, so give me a sec. The reason the Wii was so successful is because Nintendo did look at sort of a wider community of potential customers rather than just gamers and basically said, we want to make a console that everyone will want to buy. And then they did, and they were very successful at that.
Yeah.
One of the things toward the end of that lifetime that started to come up was, you know, they made Wii Fit, which was hugely popular. It was a game.
Kind of the first quality of life, exactly.
Well, that's the direction I'm going in. You know, it had the balance board, which was used for exercising. It was, you know, there had been video game exercise devices before then, even dating back to the NES. There were, like, exercise
Power
bikes
pad.
With NES, NES enhancements. There were... Power pads, certainly. You know, we saw them work with Konami to bring a version of Dance Dance Revolution to the GameCube, to the Famicom. Man, that would have been something.
Especially since DDR wasn't around yet.
That's the joke. So, and then something that they announced but never released on the Wii was actually a heart rate device that would
measure
your
heart rate. Oh, yeah, the vitality sensor?
The vitality sensor, yeah, that's to track your heart rate while you're playing. And, you know, the theory was that it would give games like Wii Fit, you know, more information about you and more information about your health. And, you know, obviously some horror game designers were planning horror game uses for it. The device never released, but again, here we see Nintendo's trademark ability to take old ideas and innovate on them and to make them relevant. We now see them working on their quality of life features. We see them again working on expanding their audience appears to be their focus.
Even
again.
Something like Wii Sports in a way was kind of a callback to something like Pong.
Oh, absolutely.
In terms of being like, oh, it's a game that everyone can play, and it's tennis.
Well, yeah, I mean, again,
I personally associate
Wii precision on Nintendo's ability to design for the masses. I'm sorry.
Continue. I was saying, when I think of Wii Sports, I think of tennis. I feel like that was the one that people really connected with the most.
I would say bowling, but tennis was a big one for them. It's just that bowling was the one that I saw... older people, like I'm thinking about like my parents who are old people, but they would play bowling every
night. Well, you come from
a
bowling family, so.
But my understanding reading online is that a lot of older people were drawn to bowling because bowling used to be such a thing.
Yeah.
Either way, bowling, tennis, baseball, and the stuff they added for Motion Plus, you know, these games really resonated with people.
Yep.
And really did huge work. I remember when I first started working at the law firm I've been with for 10 years now, when the Wii came out, like people at like our holiday parties and our firm functions were bringing their Wiis in so that we would have a whole conference room dedicated to people just playing Wii golf, Wii tennis, Wii bowling. And it was practically a party in itself, even among these people who otherwise had never touched a video game before.
Right.
And that, to me, is really what you see looking back at Nintendo historically was looking, you know, we see the way that they exploited the opportunity to market playing cards to Japanese families by licensing Disney characters. Nintendo's very good at pinpointing sort of how to get an audience interested, how to sort of exploit their resources to provide a unique opportunity and game experience.
Yeah, and, like, you know, love them or hate them, they continue to innovate. I mean, the Wii, obviously, ushering in motion controls, you know, in a big way. The 3DS, I mean, with its, you know, 3D technology, even if it gives me a headache, you know, that's a pretty big technical achievement.
Have you tried it on the new 3DS?
I have. It still kind of messes with me, but I think that's just me. It's not them, it's me.
Well, no, and that's fine. I just thought it might be easier on you because a lot of people have said they felt it was easier on their eyes, but obviously, if it doesn't work for you, it doesn't work for you. So, yeah. You know, and we need to wrap this up.
And
unfortunately,
Amiibo.
I have plans tonight with one of our podcasting bros to go to a Newfound Glory concert. I'm super excited. But yeah, you know, like you say, Slaggy, we have the Amiibos.
Which
they're
is them in the toy
now.
Business again.
Yeah, they're in the toy business again. You know, making what are essentially mini statues at a super affordable rate, with a super affordable price, with a level of quality in design that, you know, no one else is touching. Like, I've seen a ton of people complain, oh, Amiibo are $12.99. But it's like, bitch, do you buy collectible figurines? Do you buy statues? Like,
especially ones that
the
have
level of
gaming functionality associated with them?
But to me, that's a separate point. Like, even just for the quality of their sculpts,
yeah,
the quality of their paint, and obviously someone's going to be like, well, some of them turned out bad. Okay, yeah, no,
every
production
peach
line has some units that look ugly.
You have a peach with no or you have a peach with no feet and it ends up being super rare and people want it.
But by and large, like, you look at, I have so many Japanese statues and figurines, stuff that are smaller and less well put together than Amiibo are, that I paid like $20 for, easy. So to get all of these Amiibo and have them be priced the way they are, with the level of detail they are, the fact that they have gaming applications at all is, to me, like an ad feature. Like, already, dude, you're telling me I can have a cool figurine of Ike from Fire Emblem for $12.99? Shit! That's already a win. How dare you? So, again, though, that's Nintendo seeing an opportunity, seeing, you know, that the figures are something that gamers want, something that fans want, and finding a way to make it super profitable for them, and for most of us who are familiar with this market, also feel like we're getting a deal. So, it's really interesting the way that Nintendo is so good at isolating markets to tap into and finding the right product for their audience.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a huge fan of the Nintendo business philosophy, which is basically to just keep trying.
And leave luck to heaven.
And keep, you know, keep trying new things, keep experimenting, take risks, and ultimately not to stagnate. I love that about Nintendo. I think it's fantastic. And, you know, we've seen it historically from them for the last 100-plus years that Nintendo's philosophy of don't stagnate, try new things has led them to fortune and glory and, you know, gaming as a whole to be more complete and elevated by their efforts.
Indeed.
Saeed, do you have anything else to say?
No, just that, you know, we also obviously have the NX coming up, so that their gaming division's not going anywhere, but, you know, also their
they're working on
DNA partnership
on mobile phones. They have been working more specifically recently with American toy companies to produce not just Amiibo, but also a line of articulated Nintendo toys.
Oh, you mean like the Wario that's sitting up on your dresser? His butt's up in the air, it kind of looks like he's about to fart.
Ew, but appropriate.
Well, it's Wario.
You know, they've also been working in recent years with Japanese companies producing Figma figures that super high quality. And we're just seeing Nintendo working on branching out and exploring more markets than ever before.
And hey,
I think we're winners for it.
The partnership with it's Universal, right?
Yeah, for an American theme park.
Or at least
theme park attractions.
Yes.
I'm still hoping for a World of Nintendo theme park, though. It'll be like World of
Monita.
Harry Potter, just Nintendo.
With Monita monitors that are like, here, let me show you the
Girl,
way to this guide.
I want to go to Nintendo Land so bad.
Basically.
All right, well, anyway.
Baby park.
What else you got? Anything?
No, just that, you know, like you said, it's a company that has a history and will continue to innovate. Has
fantastic
a history of innovation and will continue to go on that path, rather.
Fantastic. Then why don't you start reading some of those questions of the week answers.
Yep, we asked this week where you talk about the history of Nintendo from playing cards to the NX. When did you join Club Nintendo? Lowercase club, not like Club Nintendo, Club Nintendo. Your Enzyme said Super Mario Land was my jam back then. I also played my first JRPG on the Game Boy with Final Fantasy Legend.
Yes!
My first system ever was an original Game Boy, so I've been a Nintendo fan for quite a while. Yay!
Fantastic.
Little Daddy's Pizza said, I got a SNES for Christmas of 93. I was 7. A couple years before that, I used to play my neighbor's NES all the time.
Awesome.
Over on the Book of Faces, which still sounds like it's a...
Silent Hill?
Yes, Silent Hill Book of Faces. Although Silent Hill, anything other than Patchy Slot these days is, you know, probably a rarity. We got a comment from Garrett D., host of Tables, Ladder, and Podcast, saying, my mom came home with an NES one day, but I didn't firmly become a gamer until a couple years later when I got my first issue of Nintendo Power, issue 41 specifically, the one about Mario Kart. And all of my favorite video games are SNES RPGs, so SNES is my favorite era by default. And that's awesome. And we were chatting the other day, and Garrett actually sent a picture. He found it when he was, like, doing some cleaning, so he still has that. And that's awesome, so thank you for your feedback. We figured that most of you, you know, are in our generation, that we wouldn't be hearing anyone saying, oh, well, when I was in Japan, stationed in Japan in 63, I went to the Love Hotel, and... You know, met a fine young lass.
Oh, my.
But, you know, so it's always nice to, you know, kind of hear where you came into the Nintendo story. But if you do know anyone out there who, like, has some Nintendo playing cards with Disney or, you know, like, anything kind of out of the ordinary like that, if you have an Ultra Hand somewhere... Particularly for our listeners in Japan, if you have any old family heirlooms of love testers or whatever they may be, we'd love to hear about that. But for now, I think we're going to hear about what we've been playing and what's up on the What's Up.
I said, hey, what's going on?
So this week, I have been playing Destiny, surprise.
Of course you have.
Surprise to no one. I'm working on getting all three of my character slots raid geared and ready now.
You have three characters now?
Two of them are there, and so one is just level 3 or 4, so, you know, just started. But she will also get there. It's going to be awesome.
Well, maybe I should start so I can play with your new character.
You should. It would be super cool, man. Let's see. We also had Triforce Heroes I've been playing. I picked it up during Target's current buy two, get one free. I had a really bad week at work. I ended up buying like 6 games and getting 2 free. Or buying 4 games and getting 2 free. Including games I wasn't even sure I was ever going to buy. Stuff like Assassin's Creed Syndicate and Amiibo Festival, Animal Crossing. So expect some... non-traditional what's ups for me in the future. Either way, though, Triforce Heroes, man, so good. I talked about it when I played the demo, but it is, you know, it's the best qualities of Four Swords Adventure, that type of gameplay. But again, you know, iterated on and grown to a new and even radder experience.
In some ways, it also reminds me of the Nintendo Land game a little bit, where you were the four Links and you had to go through these little... you know, rooms with different objectives.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally feel you there. And I see that as a good thing. I mean, you know, again, we have Nintendo iterating on good ideas, taking ideas from multiple different past games and combining them in a new and interesting way. And it's, to me, it's just fantastic. I love playing it.
I love it, too. I've been playing, obviously, with you. And I think it's like a level of freshness that the Zelda franchise needs.
I absolutely agree.
And it's really queer. And sorry to interrupt. It's really kind of queer, and the writing is so clever.
Accurate. Okay, so the last game I've been playing a whole lot of is Yo-Kai Watch.
Me too.
You know, we've been talking about Yo-Kai Watch for years now. It's huge in Japan.
It's getting huge here.
Now that I've put in some hours on it, I totally get it. Like, I get why this game is gigantic. Yeah. It's fantastic. I was worried it was going to be a little bit more Pokemon clone-y, but I actually don't feel like it's a Pokemon clone at all.
Yeah.
It plays more like a story-based JRPG that happens to have monster collection happening. All of the various little, like, side quests and stuff you're doing are always related to yokai, and, you know, it's just really cool to me that the yokai ultimately have stories attached to them rather than just like, oh, this is a Pidgey I found on Route 17. It's mm-hmm. like, oh no, this is
Jibanyan.
This is Jibanyan. He was hit by a truck and killed, and now his wandering spirit is trying to become an amazing fighter so that he can destroy cars and impress his former owner. Like, that makes me feel so much more attached to my monsters.
Right.
And as a result, you
except
know,
for Boohoo.
I'm already invested in the story. I like Boohoo. I'm already invested in the story. I like the battle system, which is somewhat unique. And I'm really feeling it. I'm super into it. And I used to be like, you know, some people actually like Pokemon or Yo-Kai Watch more than Pokemon. I used to be like, y'all bitch is crazy. Yo-Kai Watch might be good, but it can't be that good. And now I'm like, I don't know if I'm there.
It's a level 5 game.
I don't know if I'm there, but I get it. I get how someone could be there. And that's already a pretty big step.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. You know, level 5 is wonderful. I really like the way that it focuses on just one town rather than, you know, traveling around the world, searching far and wide, each Pokemon to understand the power that's inside. And it reminds me a lot, you know, the map, little map, overworld map makes me think of Fantasy Life, obviously, a lot. So it's almost like Fantasy Life Monsters.
Ah, but, I mean, yeah. So that's what I've been playing. So, like, have you been playing anything else?
Well, we've been playing some Civ 5 lately.
Oh, snap, that's right. We have been playing Civ 5. You know, we're always down to play, even with any of our listeners. If any of y'all out there in Internet
Just
Radio Land...
Just be forewarned, Captain Spike's going to win.
If any of y'all out there in Internet Radio Land want to play multiplayer Civ with us sometime, just hit us up.
I think we need to start putting you on a higher difficulty to level the playing field a little bit.
You know, I feel like there's some weird quirks with the way difficulty works in multiplayer of Civ 5, but we can talk about it off air, of course.
I'm like, because you always win.
Okay, yeah, there's just, I recall there being some issues with, like, people with disparate difficulties, and it's like, it balances out the difficulty overall on the whole
world. Oh, for the AI.
For the AI,
and
like,
oh, thanks, barbarians are now invading you.
So I feel like that's what I read. I used to read a lot about Civ 5 on the Civ 5 subreddit, and people were, you know, really taking apart the numbers and data and what it all means, but I need to do a little more reading before I felt comfortable making a change like that. But, you know, if we can just give you a handicap that way, I'd be happy to.
Well, thanks. I have to say, like, playing with you again has really got me trying to step up my Civ game. I'm starting to really learn, like, you know, how culture wins, or, you know, how culture could win. So
excellent, excellent. All right, well, let's get this ball rolling then. Do we have any more social links?
We do.
Now's the time for them.
And a lot of it ties in with our SNES episode. Lil Daddy's Pizza posted a selfie with his cart of Evo, The Search for Eden.
Yes!
The best game about trying to fuck a planet ever.
I heart you.
Neo Okami on Twitter says, flying dinosaur for life, in reply to that. Your enzyme said, dude, you've reminded me of Evo. Can't believe I forgot about it. What a fantastic little game. Also,
I can't believe you forgot about it either.
Also, one of my SNES memories is regret. I sold mine and all of my games to buy a PS1, crying emoji.
Downgrade.
Yeah. Embryon X joining in the Evo conversation saying, I sunk countless hours into that game as a kid. Hearts for eyes emoji. Dino phase equals fave.
Yes! Man, I love you all so much.
Crystal Ideas said, gummy bears, because you started singing the gummy bears theme
song. Bouncing here and there and everywhere.
See, I was about DuckTales and Chippendale and Darkwing Duck more so.
Bitch, as if I wasn't.
Well, you're about the gargoyles. But anyways, Crystal Ideas saying, also Tetris Attack, love it! I've played through it so many times, starting it easy and playing through the hard. And Sulker, a.k.a. Monarch Piratica, saying, or I should say Monarch Piratica, a.k.a. Sulker, saying, thank you for the shout-out to my Extra Life Fund.
You are quite welcome. It is my pleasure.
And Miru69 saying, another awesome episode of GameBui.org and Koopa Club. Woohoo! And that retro code is saying, the latest GameBui.org episode celebrating 25 years of the Super Famicom was not only informative, but makes me miss the days of the SNES. I feel that. I basically tell Captain Spike all the time that I wish it was just 1992 forever.
I don't know about all that. I need culture and art.
Yeah, the culture and art of 1992.
Ah! Oh, you.
With that, we love your feedback.
We love your feedback.
We like your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews.
We like them.
Even when iTunes is being a pain. We like Stitcher Radio, so thank you to those of you who tune in to us over there.
Thanks.
We like your Facebook likes.
We like your likes.
We effing love Twitter.
We effing love Twitter.
And you can email us at mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
You're welcome. I mean, mailbuoy@gamebuoy.org.
And, of course, our home base is at GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
Where our social links, our complete episode archive, and all of that thing.
Did you do the at GameBuoy.org with the .org spelled out, D-O-T-O-R-G?
No, but that's our Twitter.
Woohoo! Twitter! Yes!
Captain Spike, shout-out to the shout-outs.
As ever and always, my first shout-out goes out to VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends, as well as Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice, and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. I'd be remiss not to mention Nintendo Fun Club, your place for platformers positivity and pop punk, as well as Nintendo Love Fest, which does exactly what it says on the tin. You should also check out their sister show, X Nation, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants, as well as Slagkick's side project, the currently off-season Reading is Fundamental, which takes a look, week after week, at the current episodes of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Gentlemen,
that
start your
engines. Myself, as well as Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio, and Delvin from VG Realness. You were saying...
Gentlemen, start your engines.
You should also check out the Starboard Power Coupling podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail, which is hosted by Matt, with whom I'm going to be going and seeing a pretty cool concert
in a few hours.
I need to
get
out
on the train.
Here. So, last but certainly not least, we have Tables, Ladders, and Podcast, a professional podcast, professional wrestling podcast for the common man. Slaggy, take us to a game bar!
Game Bar is the gay video game Prairie Home Companion and a part of the Hunty Bunch, along with Koopa Club, an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist, along with the Joystick Jockeys, two LGBTQ gamers who love games and love talking about them, and our LGBTQ cuties, along with La Palanca Podcast, podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español. I also would like to direct your attention over to the Voice of Geeks Network, that's vognetwork.com, where you can get all sorts of nerdy content, including LLR, Starboard Power Coupling Podcast, and Girls Gone Wild, where you can get a female perspective on the world's most popular MMO. You know, BlizzCon just happened. We didn't talk about it a lot here, but, you know, some exciting things happening in the world of Blizzard and WoW, and actually, you know, some interesting things. So go check them out. And I'd also like to direct you to a little show called Anime Buoy. It's your port of call for anime news, tidbits, and discussions that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. Hosted by two guys known as Captain Spike and First Mate Slagkick. They just did an episode about Interstellar 5555, the Daft Punk and Leiji Matsumoto collaboration.
They? Really? You're doing the...
I'm talking in the third person. Also...
Are you, like, writing your own bio for your first novel, and you're like, they?
Also, the Game Buoy hosts would like to shout out to Zelda Reorchestrated, where they use their theme music from. You know, this is the late, great project that aimed to reorchestrate Zelda music into beautiful symphonic sound. They unfortunately closed their doors, but we will forever continue to pour out a 40 into the great fairy fountain, possibly while wearing cheerleading Link outfits.
You got some problems.
Okay, what about the new Fierce Deity outfit that they're getting?
As ever and always, I want to thank everybody so much for listening to us. I hope that you have enjoyed listening half as much as we've enjoyed
Captain Spike and
lovely Sunday sunny afternoon.
Captain Spike and First Mate Slagkick, so appreciate your listenership.
We have some exciting stuff to come in the next few weeks, so please look forward to it. But until then, keep gaming, keep thinking, and
Mina, miteite kure! First Mate Slagkick doesn't understand what that means.
Ice Bear needs food badly. Mics are hot.
God of Wars, the Godzi War, Third Wars, Runners for First, Well, I think they did pretty well. You know, Captain Spike really did a good job leading the discussion, and, you know, First Mate had some things to say, so I think they should feel pretty proud of their episode.
I fucking can't with you.
And I think they're going to be talking about Animal Crossing, right? So they probably should be playing some Amiibo Festival next time they get together.
Oh, my God. Please stop.
Well, I guess they got to get going, right?
Please don't do this anymore.